Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In her new book, The Unspeakable Mind, Dr. Shelley Jane delivers a comprehensive and definitive guide to post-traumatic stress disorder. PTSD science has come a long way in the last decade, but to act like it's new is to not have paid attention to human history. Ancient societies have long written about traumatic stress. It's mostly noted in the history of war, phrases like combat fatigue, being shell-shocked, even the term flashback. Today, we know more than we've ever have about PTSD and what causes it, and it's certainly a huge issue for the military, but PTSD can also show up after a loss of a loved one, physical and sexual assault, child abuse. But science is going a long way to identify PTSD beyond the effects on the brain. As Dr. Jane notes in her book, it's not a mental disorder brought on by poor lifestyle choices or moral weakness or character flaws, but instead a complex interplay between genes, biology, and environment. This is not a brain disorder. Scientists have discovered that it affects your cells, your organs, other parts of your body, and it could be generational. Dr. Shelley Jane is one of the foremost scientists working on PTSD today. She currently serves as the medical director for integrated care at the VA, Palo Alto Healthcare System, also as well teaches at Stanford. The book is called The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. And Dr. Shelley Jane is my guest on Extension 720. Dr. Jane, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So it's not a coincidence, and I love the book, but it's not a coincidence that the word unspeakable shows up in the title of this book. I never thought about the way we use the word unspeakable, unspeakable crimes, unspeakable acts, and this idea of not recognizing trauma and the things that go associated with that. Talk about how we as a society in the past have used that word in different ways.
So, you know, I think humans are hardwired to deny traumatic events. You know, a lot of times traumatic events represents a violation of everything you hold to be sacred and dear. And so when you live through one, there is this inclination, they're just too terrible to utter aloud. They are unspeakable. And sometimes the survivor wants to speak up, but the wider society isn't ready to hear them. Mm-hmm. You know, when we think of like really stigmatized crimes like sexual violence or child abuse. So then the events become unspeakable because of that. The problem is PTSD thrives when trauma remains unspeakable.
There's a great point you mentioned just about the human being that wants to not speak of these things, but at the same time that wants to. There's this real desire for us to shout to the rooftops of what happened to us, but it almost feels like when we are involved in traumatic events, our first inclination is to suppress it.
Yes, and that's, you've really hit on an important point, because a lot of times survivors, they'll oscillate between those two points, right? On one hand, they want to deny the event, they want to forget about it, they don't want to think about it. But on the other hand, I do think there is this innate human desire to, when there's been an injustice, you want to narrate to the world and let them know what happened to you. So survivors often switch between the two viewpoints. As a listener, it can be really chaotic to listen to that story. It can make you really uncomfortable because you can't make sense of it. And that's why, unfortunately, a lot of times throughout history, trauma survivors, they've been deemed not credible and people don't listen to them.
And they also probably lose confidence in telling that story because people are not accepting or understanding what they're trying to say.
Yeah, absolutely. If you don't have a good listener or someone who can bear witness, you're going to think twice, because there's a lot of vulnerability in sharing that story.
I mentioned in the intro just this idea that ancient civilizations and societies, for all the talk of PTSD in the last decade, even since the war in Iraq, and it became a name for trauma, for traumatic stress, everyone kind of feels like, oh, it's new, this is something. But when you look back and you see, and you have done this, in ancient civilizations and the way that they have known about traumatic stress and named it different things, it's kind of alarming in the way that this has been a part of the human existence since the beginning of time.
Yeah, absolutely. It has been, but it's really elusive. It kind of slips in and out of our social consciousness. And I think, you know, getting a hold of it and keeping it there and not forgetting about it is so crucial, because otherwise we lose ground. You know, so for example, every time there's been a war, like World War One and World War Two, and then Vietnam, there was this increased surge in interest in trauma and traumatic stress, and then it just goes back down again. And so it's accrued so many names, like you said, shell shock, battle fatigue, you know, battered women syndrome, child abuse syndrome. But the problem is, when it's all wishy-washy like that, you got to give it a name to be able to study it, right? To be able to cross that sea of myths, you need measurement, you need to define something, you need to study it. And I think that's why it's so important that we give it a name and we keep it in our kind of collective consciousness.
From the scientific community, it's also important, because how active have they been in the past of studying this? I mean, because you're right, it comes up at wars, World War One, World War Two, Vietnam. Were scientific communities interested in traumatic stress at that point, or is it more just an easy way to categorize people who are affected by it?
I think there's always been interest, you know, so people like me who are interested in behavioral health and mental health issues, I think there was always curious, you know, psychiatrists and trauma scientists who were noticing, hey, what is this? We need to pay attention to this. But then when attention shifts, the problem is, you know, you can't get funding to support your ideas, you can't get people to listen to you, and then it becomes this fight. Now, what's important to know about PTSD is it could impact any of us, but the socially disadvantaged are the most vulnerable. And I do think there is this kind of political social element that, well, who cares if women and children or people from low socioeconomic groups are having to deal with this? And it was a lot of advocacy work, Vietnam veteran era advocacy groups, women's rights groups. They were pivotal in bringing this diagnosis into the kind of diagnostic Bible in 1980.
Yeah, you're so right, too, because it really feels like our society, when you think of even the 70s and 80s, I'm only thinking about the life that I know, those kind of shelters or any sort of resources that were allocated to battered women, to child abuse, to even war veterans, was on the fringes. It was always very – my mom is a social worker. She was a part of it. They never had funding. It was always ancillary. It was always trying to get some sort of money for this. And it almost feels like it was almost a society's way overall as humans of suppressing, not unlike the victims did.
So true. So true. You know, PTSD can operate on a denial of it can operate on a societal basis, too. It's not just individual. And you need legal rights, right? I mean, there was a time when it was not illegal for a man to assault his wife, you know, and so you need legal rights for the victim to be able to say, well, look at the consequences. So in some ways, I feel like we live in better times. And definitely, if you look at like digital platforms and the internet, I think we're hearing a lot of voices that before we just never would have heard. And so in some ways, there's been this kind of democratization of PTSD, which I think can only be a good thing.
It is a good thing. But again, it almost feels like there's misunderstanding or misinterpretation from a mainstream world, the mainstream news. It will always be categorized as a mental disorder. It'll always be categorized as psychological in some form. People can't handle what they saw. But there's so much more as the science reveals the impact, the biological impact it has on people, that not unlike addiction and what we're learning about addiction, that it's less about a choice or the mental fortitude and more about an illness or something that has a full long-standing impact on the human body that you can't control.
Yeah, and we've come a long way in understanding this. I think one of the first things that often get misinformed about PTSD is just because you're exposed to trauma doesn't mean you have PTSD. That is incorrect, and I think the term gets used too much. The reality is the vast majority of humans will recover naturally after exposure to trauma, even a horrific trauma, the worst thing. Humans, by design, were psychologically resilient. The vast majority will recover, but a substantial minority will not, and they will develop PTSD. And a lot of what determines who does and who does not, believe it or not, it's genetics. A third of that is determined by genetics, literally how we're wired in our brain and how our body mounts a response to stress determines whether or not we'll develop PTSD.
That's a fascinating point that I think a lot of people, myself included, that PTSD is something that is diagnosed after the person hasn't recovered on their own.
Yes.
Meaning that, you know, I may be a victim of trauma or had trauma in my life, but my body, because I'm resilient, I'm a human being, it takes whatever that finite amount of time is, it cycles out. But when it doesn't cycle out, and it may be because of genetic causes, that's when the scientific and medical community gets involved and gives it a distinction or a designation.
Yeah, that's what you would hope. There's still millions of people who never get a diagnosis, never get access to mental health care. That's a whole other issue, but that's what you would hope. And typically what happens is like a month, 6 weeks, 8 weeks after experience the event, the person is not getting on the road to recovery and the symptoms are getting worse and worse, and it's impacting their ability to love and create and work and play. And that's when, you know, it enters the realm of a psychological condition that warrants the attention of a mental health professional.
I'm going to take a break, and we come back, let's talk about what some of those symptoms are. When you get to the point when you're at 8 weeks and there's checklists, there's other ways that the scientific and medical community can diagnose PTSD. In studio with me, Dr. Shelley Jane. She is the author of The Unspeakable Mind, find stories of trauma and healing from the front lines of PTSD science. She's my guest tonight. We're talking about PTSD here on Extension 720, so stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest, Dr. Shelley Jane. She is the author of The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. We're talking about PTSD, not necessarily as you know it. So the reason I really love the book is that it did challenge my own understanding and my own notions about what PTSD was. And I even think about growing up in an era when this would have been late 70s and early 80s, where Vietnam vets were ostracized because of their flashbacks, because of their unstable, or at least their perceived unstable behavior. And we saw this, and I don't know, there was a point there where you didn't necessarily say that's a disorder. You just almost chalked it up as that's what war does. I don't know what it was. It just wasn't necessarily categorized the way we're talking about it today.
Yeah, so I feel like, you know, naming it tames it. And that's why it's nice to understand the symptoms, because then you can understand the behaviors. So, you know, rather than saying people are quote unquote acting weird or quote unquote acting crazy, which is very stigmatizing and distances people from them, if we can get into the experience that the human being's having who's experiencing traumatic stress, you can have a lot more empathy. Because if that happened to any of us, we would be exactly the same way.
Right.
So, you know, in terms of symptoms, the ones that PTSD is famous for, like, is, say, like nightmares, and this is when they replay the trauma in their sleep every night, and these can be really disabling. They can get them a few times a week for weeks, months, years after the trauma. So you can even start to imagine just the impact on their quality of sleep. So nightmares, that they're famous, flashbacks, where they're literally reliving the trauma in the present moment. So even though they might be in front of you, they are reliving something that happened in the past, and they may act out. So if they may act out a battle scene, or they may start to run, or they may start to scream or shout. Really disorienting experience for the person who's having it. And then exaggerated startle response, that's another one. You know, they hear a car backfire and they hit the ground because they assume that it's a bomb going off, or they assume that it's gunfire. So the body is reacting before the brain has a chance to even process what is going on.
The book, and it says it right in the stories of trauma and healing. Mm-hmm. There are personal stories in here from you and working with patients and others. Tell me about Rita. The reason I bring up Rita is because part of this, too, is about people who don't understand what trauma has done to them, or that they're even experiencing PTSD or are part of it. Mm-hmm. Rita came in, and I forgot what she was even coming in for, but when you started going through the checklist, you started to recognize.
That was a moment for me that I was really naive about. If you look at the epidemiological work that has been done on trauma exposure alone, it's actually really common. Something like 50% of women, 60% of men in America will say that at one point in their life they survived a major traumatic event. And there's a subset who survive many events. So the reality is if you go through your life and you don't experience a major trauma, you're actually part of a very, very, very lucky minority. And that was an experience I had when I was a fellow, when I was training to be a PTSD specialist, that I would go through this checklist and I would ask patients about every trauma they would have been exposed to in their life. And I was honestly, I was looking at this checklist and I'm like, really, who's going to answer yes to all of this?
Right.
Like, but then I was going through it and I was astounded. And this patient who was Puerto Rican and a woman, she had to sift through 50 years of memories. And actually, when I asked her, she was like, oh, yeah, I witnessed my cousin die in a car accident, or she herself was a survivor of intimate partner violence. And here we go. And it comes out, and forget the current trauma that she was here to get help for. And that was a really eye-opening moment for me. And even for her, it was only when someone asked her and she pulled the memories that she was like, boy, I've been through a lot. So this speaks to the human brain and body's capacity. You kind of habituate to what your circumstances are, right? We're trained to survive. And if that's what it is, we get on with it. But there is a psychological toll and an emotional toll that we have to pay attention to.
And there are so many great stories in this book, one of which, and there, of course, Rita's, there's the other story about a woman who you saw, who was in, he was in the emergency room of the hospital, who had severe abdominal pain, right? Just this idea that none of the medical community could figure out what the pain was coming from. They do a test, they do everything else. They're like, I don't know what, and this is, I'm sure a lot of people listening have gone to the doctor for some reason or another and said, this hurts. And they're like, I can't help. I don't know what's, everything looks fine.
Right.
And then you got a chance to talk to her. And again, trauma plays a role.
Yeah, absolutely. So for many people, the way trauma manifests is physical. in the body, you know, with physical pain, with symptoms, abdominal pains, migraines, headaches, back pain. Because especially I think when the trauma is very unspeakable, and in my experience where I typically see this is when people have survived pretty severe childhood trauma, where for children who are young, their brains are developing, their bodies are developing, a lot of times the only way they can deal with the trauma is to literally put it away, lock it away, and throw away the key and kind of dissociate from it. But yeah, it has a way of catching up. And a lot of times you'll see this with this manifestation of pain, which is not explained by your kind of general medical workups, you know, the x-rays, the MRIs, right. The scans, everything's normal. But I think the important point here is it's very real. These people aren't making it up.
That is a big problem. Yeah. I can't tell you how many times, whether it be me or my loved ones or friends or whatever, talk about that they've got some sort of back problem, knee problem, whatever it is, and the medical community is like, we looked at it and it's fine. I don't know what, it's in your head. And
they're insulting, right?
It's insulting, yeah. But there is a peel back. There is a way that what you're talking about in your work and in this book, that many of these patients have survived or have been exposed to some serious trauma in their lives, and this is how it's manifesting.
Right. And the trick, really, rather than shutting it down, oh, well, there's nothing we can do for you because we've done all of our checklists and you're fine, you got to be curious. You got to open up the conversation, because a lot of times the person themselves may not be connecting the dots. And the thing is, this doesn't go just for PTSD, it goes for like depression. Mm-hmm. I mean, so many mental health conditions can manifest physically.
In this line of work, when PTSD is not new, but the distinction is new, and you're learning new things through the science each and every day, how do you make sure, or how do you discern it? How is it different than, say, depression or other things that may be in the same category or close to disorders that are similar to PTSD? Mm-hmm. How do you make sure that it's not just something that's an acute case of depression or acute case of something else and not necessarily based on trauma?
Typically what you'd hear in the story that there was some significant trauma, so you'd screen for the trauma, so that would be one hint. Mm-hmm. And those symptoms that I was talking about earlier, the nightmares, the flashbacks, the exaggerated startle response, they're very textbook PTSD.
And they're very unique.
Very unique to PTSD. Yeah, right. You're not really going to find that in other health conditions. The other element of PTSD, the thing that's very unique to PTSD, is this construct of avoidance. Like, a lot of people will build their life to avoid any reminders or triggers of the trauma, because that's the only way they can get through life with this like tunnel like focus on just getting through. They white knuckle it through life. But they'll avoid, you know, for example, if they're combat survivors, they'll avoid crowds. They will avoid people who remind them of that period of their life. Emotionally, they'll constrict their lives. They won't want to love. They won't want to experience joy. They will mute their happiness.
Which leads to other things like depression.
So, great point. PTSD and depression often go hand in hand.
And drug use. And
PTSD and addiction often go hand in hand. Right. So it's very common, very rare for me to meet someone who only has that. They all go hand in hand. They're all related, but there are some distinct features of PTSD.
The one area that I think a lot of people listening are glued to is the generational or the hereditary part. Mm-hmm. That this is beyond just something that one person experiences the trauma. Once the trauma is experienced and your body almost rewires itself around it, it has the ability to pass on to the next generation or to the people around you, to family. That's the part that I don't think people have wrapped their head around. Mm-hmm. That trauma doesn't just affect one person. It can affect many.
Yeah, it's infectious.
So let's do that. We'll talk about that coming up. Dr. Shelley Jane's my guest. She's the author of The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. And she's my guest tonight in Extension 720. We'll take a quick break, come back, and continue the conversation. So stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio tonight, Dr. Shelley Jane. She is the author of the book, The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. As she would know, she currently serves as a medical director for integrated care at the VA and Palo Alto Healthcare System, as well as teaches at Stanford. She's been involved with PTSD science really your entire career. I mean, this is something that you have really sunk your teeth into, to be something that you are dedicating your work and your knowledge and your career to. Why do you do that?
So in terms of the clinician, like, I've been a doctor for 20 years, and that's part and parcel of your life. You meet people who have suffered trauma all the time. So the clinical part for 20 years, the science part more for the last 10 years. So I have a personal connection to the field because I have my own family history of trauma and tragedy in the 1947 partition of British India that I only came to know of.
It's a great story.
2007. Yeah. So I took a road trip with my dad to celebrate his 70th birthday. He was visiting from England, where I was born. born and raised, and he still lives there to this day. And he started narrating the story of what happened to him in 1947, started telling me about his family upbringing in India, where he was born and lived as a boy. You know, I'd always known that my paternal grandfather had been murdered in the kind of horrific violence that accompanied partition, but I really only had nuts and bolts of the story.
Bits and pieces throughout your life, right?
So disconnected from it. And again, now as a trauma scientist, I see that's the way trauma is. You're so disconnected from it. I was raised in England, thousands of miles away, didn't have much to do with India, no connection to my ancestors because they were dead, right? So,
and coordinated off, meaning this is how I'm going to live my life without having to think about it.
But yeah, I mean, it was hard enough kind of growing up in England when you're an immigrant kid, and it was just hard to find a connection to it. You know, I didn't have any photographs of my grandparents, didn't have any heirlooms, like nothing to latch on to. So I just really thought, well, okay, that story, I didn't know how to make sense of it. But on this road trip, by this time I was a psychiatrist, and what was fascinating about the way my dad narrated the story was that there's a lot more cohesion to the story. It was very much thoughtfully kind of laid out. It was stripped of the anger and the bitterness and the fear that used to accompany it when I was a kid. And I realized it for what it was. By that time, he was the sole surviving member of his family of origin. So what he was giving me was testimony.
And he said afterwards that that was on purpose. Like he wanted to tell you this story because it was important to you and your family and who you were going to be.
Right. And he felt strongly that, you know, if you have an education, if you have a platform, if you have a voice, you should really use it for something of value. And that's what he felt strongly. And for me, my way of kind of processing that was like, well, okay, I'm a doctor. Like, okay, why don't I become a PTSD specialist? Why don't I try and advance the science of PTSD?
And advancing you are. I mean, this is, we're getting to the future part of this conversation, is what's going to happen next. Because there are treatments available for PTSD. It's whether it be therapies. There's been trials and clinical trials with medicines and pills and things like that. But there does seem to be, because, and this goes back to the same thing we're talking about at the beginning of this conversation. When you put a name to something, it seems like the scientific community, there are more people getting involved in this, that there seem to be more studies and more even governmental intervention, meaning they want to know more about this stuff. It seems like a different time in 2019 than, say, the last time that people got interested in traumatic stress.
Yeah, it is a good time, and I'm optimistic. I think this is a great time to be in the field of PTSD. We've really benefited from this massive surge in science since 9/11, since the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, since like major natural disasters like Hurricane Katrina. Huge growth in the science of PTSD, and all types, like you said, not just pharmacological or neurobiological, health services research, epidemiological research. And that body of evidence just continues to grow exponentially. So it's really good times. I think we're getting much better at knowing how to
let's get back to the generational point. This is a part that kind of blew my mind about the book, that it is, because just as we're talking about, the trauma is not necessarily mental, it is physiological. It travels throughout the body. It's genes, it's biology, it's everything we learned in biology class in high school. But this concept that because of that, it can be passed on to next generations and next generation, that trauma almost becomes part of your DNA.
Yeah, so there's this fascinating field called epigenetics. And, you know, I should say we're still early days, but it is really enticing. There's enough out there that I think it's safe to say that, you know, when a man is exposed to a major trauma and develops PTSD, or a woman is, it has an impact on the man's sperm and the woman's eggs. And because of that, changes are passed down via this process called intergenerational transmission to any future offspring they might have. And these changes manifest in the form of like altered neurobiology, altered genes. So the kind of stunning thing is that their offspring can kind of carry these sorrows in their own blood, even though their kids may never be exposed to a trauma. But if they were to be exposed to a trauma,
it could trigger whatever is in the DNA sequence.
Yes,
right?
They're going to respond to the trauma with that cumulative history, right? Family history. So when you think of mass traumatization, when you think of torture, slavery, genocide, right?
It's a great point, right?
There you go. So then PTSD's deep footprint can last generations.
Now, again, our society plays a big role. We saw in how society has, even in the word, in the name of this book, with Unspeakable, there's some traumas that we just don't have answers to, so we're like, just push it down. When you talk about this intergenerational or just generational DNA being passed down from trauma to trauma, and you think about things that are just awful, whether it be genocide or slavery and things of that nature, Do we risk politically the world tamping that down because that's what human beings do and saying this is not necessarily where we don't want to know more about this. Let's just put this all
away. It's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Right? Because it brings up a lot of, like you say, very controversial and kind of provocative topics in our culture. But, you know, just because something's uncomfortable doesn't mean we shouldn't pay attention to it, right? And I think that's where we can have most movement. If we're curious, let's just be curious. No one's saying we've got the science of epigenetics down. There's so much more to know. It's still an evolving piece. But let's not ignore that what we're finding. And the first lesson for me is, we have to take care of women who are pregnant. We have to take care of young children. Like, these are the first major lessons, you know, that all these processes are just so vulnerable to being disrupted.
You mentioned earlier, and we kind of glossed over it, but when we talk about PTSD, a lot of times it almost, I'll have conversations, and we've done this many times on this radio, that PTSD and military are hand in hand. Mm-hmm. It's all about soldiers coming home and, mm-hmm. and transitions mm-hmm. and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. Rarely does PTSD and trauma be almost attached to people living in poverty mm-hmm. or, you know, people who have dealt with trauma in some form. We just had Alex Kotlowitz in and we talked about the traumatic stress that happens to people who are living in Chicago where there's gun violence, but are left behind, mm-hmm. meaning their friends, loved ones, mm-hmm. family, things of that nature, that mm-hmm. not the victims or not even the shooter, but just and part the shooter. Mm-hmm. But this idea that there is all this trauma that nobody is paying attention to that is festering and building up because of things that they witnessed, that they're a part of, that lived through.
Right. So, like you said, you know, of course, our military personnel have high rates of PTSD because of their occupational exposure to trauma.
And first responders, too.
First responders, police, firefighters, low-income women and youth who are raised in high-crime, inner-city areas where there's a lot of poverty, they're really high-risk, too. So we forget that piece of it. And so, you know, if you're growing up in an environment where you're not sure if you're going to be safe, like literally your life could be threatened, where people you love are maybe being murdered on the street, and you're dealing with loss and grief, and you're growing up in that, your body is going to be mm-hmm. reacting the same way you would to, you know, it's a trauma in itself, and your mm-hmm. body is going to be developing and reacting in that way, and you're going to have the same kind of consequences. And that's where access to mental health care is huge, because a lot of times people who live in impoverished areas do not have access to adequate mental health care, don't have access to adequate health care, period, never mind mental health care. And that's why your zip code is huge. Zip code goes a huge way in determining your ability to be resilient in the face of trauma.
Do you feel, as you mentioned, the cumulative effect of generations? Let's say you're in a position where you are someone who lives in a high crime area, mm-hmm. and you develop, obviously, PTSD from the trauma that you've experienced mm-hmm. and your young mother, mm-hmm. lose a loved one in some mm-hmm. form. They pass it on to the next generation. Mm-hmm. That generation is faced with their own trauma mm-hmm. in that moment, and there's mm-hmm. a trigger to where all of the cumulative effect of that's in the DNA sequence, you can understand why the pattern continues. You can understand why, without adequate health care and mm-hmm. mental health care, that people are having adverse effects to trauma, whatever it might be, meaning that more crime, more erratic behavior, whatever it might be, mm-hmm. there you can start to see a sequence that is different than the, I guess, the storylines that have been fed to the media about what is happening in some of these areas.
Well, you definitely get a sense for the vicious cycle nature of it, right? And how entrenched it is.
Right.
And I think you just get a bigger perspective that it's more than the trauma we're dealing with in the moment. There's a history here that is impacting the picture we're seeing at the moment.
Right.
So, you know, the next question becomes, how do we break these cycles? We have to. And I definitely feel, you know, there's no need to be like, we don't need to feel fatalistic about this. You know, I don't think we're a walking, talking product of our genes. We need to intervene. Right. Education is key. Access to mental health care is key. Elevating the mental health literacy about PTSD to the general public, which is a big part of the push to write the book, frankly, you know, getting more information out there. So we do have this option that we can break this cycle, but it's going to require a lot of collective will. I don't think any one individual is going to be able to do this by themselves.
As you look at the future of PTSD awareness, but also cures for PTSD, is it going to come in the form, as you kind of mentioned in the book at one point, blood scans and CT scans? I mean, is it, or blood work? Are you going to be able to know about the trauma and whether or not someone is suffering from just comprehensive labs.
So that's the dream, right? And that's kind of the direction that a lot of hardworking people in my field are trying to go into, where we get very precise about biology. And, you know, the same way we have a blood test to show whether or not you have diabetes, and we can monitor your progress, or we can do a scan to see if you have a tumor. You know, that's the direction that people want to go to with psychiatry, that, you know, we want to have a blood test and we want to be able to, you know, diagnose really quickly and be very definitive about it. I'm really hopeful for that time, but I'm also a pragmatist. I don't think that time is coming anytime soon, but we need people. We have people who need help today, and right. We have to find ways to help those people right now.
What are they? I mean, is it what's available to someone who is suffering from PTSD right now?
So talk therapy is the gold standard. You know, mm-hmm. If I had someone in my life who I loved with PTSD, I would want them to have access to a well-qualified therapist who could offer talk therapies. There's some specific ones, like EMDR is one, PE is another one, CPT. These are very tried and trusted therapies for PTSD that have been shown to be effective in controlled trials. So that's like kind of the gold mm-hmm, standard. Mm-hmm. So that's a great place to start. Just because they're effective doesn't mean they work for everybody.
Right.
And then there are some other types of therapies that don't focus on the trauma as much. They focus more on the consequences of the trauma. So how to manage your day-to-day life and your emotions and your relationships in that kind of trauma-informed way, but maybe not looking directly at the trauma, because that is very difficult for a lot of people. So there's other options in terms of therapies. For many people, medication still is an option, because sometimes the physiological arousal is just so much. The idea of sitting and talking about mm-hmm. it's just hard for people to get there sometimes, and medications can really help take the edge off of symptoms.
And it's really about the symptoms, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And there's many reasons. You know, sometimes for people it's a luxury. They can't come for therapy 10, 12 weeks in a row. They've got small kids at home, or they've got jobs, or they're in school, or they don't have gas money. I mean, there are so many factors. Right. So medication is definitely an option too. And then there's a lot of interest, really intense passion for a lot of mind-body treatments. The data that we have for the mind-body stuff is not as robust as I would like to see, but they're definitely very popular, and a lot of people are saying that they're incredibly helpful. So things like yoga, tai chi, meditation, that kind of thing, acupuncture.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see where the field goes when it comes to traumatic stress and PTSD. Dr. Shelley Jain is a part of that community, and she continues to be one of the foremost experts on PTSD science. The book is called The Unspeakable Mind: Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. Dr. Jain, thanks so much for joining us tonight. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. It was my pleasure.